Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, this December 16th, 2007. Today we have a show that we've been looking forward to for a long time. We have arguably the leading liberal or progressive journalist, columnist in the United States today. Paul Krugman from the New York Times will be joining us today. Krugman has a brand new book out, The Conscience of a Liberal. We'll be talking about that book, its argument, the points he makes, and taking your calls all today live here on Media Matters. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
As 2007 winds down, congressional oversight of the FCC has been heating up, and Federal Communications Commission Chairman Kevin Martin has been in the hot seat. On December 4th, the Senate Commerce Committee approved by a unanimous voice vote the Media Ownership Act of 2007. The bill, sponsored by Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota and Republican Senator Trent Lott of Mississippi, was introduced to stop Martin from rushing through a vote on December 18th to lift the long-standing ban on one company owning a broadcast station and a major daily newspaper in the same market. Senator Dorgan.
My hope is that the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission is watching and listening, because this Congress, on a bipartisan basis, says no to further relaxing the controls on cross-ownership. And this Congress, on a bipartisan basis, I feel strongly, believes that we have too much concentration in the media.
On December 5th, all five commissioners testified at a House oversight hearing. In opening remarks, Representative John Dingell of Michigan, chairman of the Commerce Committee, listed several complaints about proceedings at the FCC.
In sum, the FCC appears to be broken. The victim of this breakdown is a fair, open, and transparent regulatory process.
Martin was grilled by several members of the committee. Representative Bart Stupak, a Democrat from Michigan, asked Martin about the 10 studies that the FCC had commissioned to analyze the state of media ownership.
Are you generally satisfied with these 10 studies?
Are we generally satisfied with the 10 studies?
Yes.
I think that they give us a general sense of what's going on.
Well, let me ask you, today. Study number one, which looks at how people get their news, is alleged to use data that excluded Latinos. Have you heard that?
Sorry, you said what then?
Your first study excluded Latinos. It was a study on how people receive their news. Excluded Latinos. Wouldn't that be a flaw in the study?
I think it doesn't capture how Latinos are actually receiving their news. No.
Well, if you don't cut them, they're excluded.
No, if they are not included.
How about number two, which focuses on TV station ownership structure, which allegedly missed 75% of the TV stations that were female-owned in 2005 and missed 69% of the TV stations that were minority-owned in 2005.
Representative Jay Inslee also called for Martin to apologize to the people who attended the public hearing in Seattle on November 9th, only to see an op-ed by Martin published in the New York Times 4 days later, in which he unveiled his new ownership rules. This week, the FCC faced a Senate Commerce Committee oversight hearing. Despite more harsh criticism, a vote on Martin's new rules is still scheduled for December 18th.
With every word that Martin speaks, the moguls, they rejoice. But oh, the poor consumer who never has a choice. Minorities, communities are left without a voice. No more rulings that just serve industry, industry. No more rulings that just serve industry.
Chicago was treated to a media-themed holiday sing-along last week. Outside the Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue, members of media advocacy group Chicago Media Action sang carols that underscored the growing public concern about increasing media concentration and its impact on the Windy City.
What do we mean by media concentration? It's the idea that fewer and fewer companies own more and more media outlets, TV stations, radio stations, cable channels, newspapers, magazines, movie studios, and internet websites.
Tribune has been operating both major newspapers and TV stations in several markets under waivers from the FCC. Tribune has lobbied hard to extend the waivers so that real estate mogul Sam Zell can complete his buyout of Tribune before the end of the year.
What does the Tribune own? It owns WGN-TV along with 23 other TV stations, WGN Superstation, WGN-AM Radio, CLTV 11 daily newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, with three Spanish-language newspapers, including Hoy Chicago Magazine Sports, and entertainment concerns, including the Chicago Cubs.
FCC Chairman Kevin Martin could have issued another temporary waiver so the Tribune sale could proceed, but Martin agreed to extend the waivers only if Tribune sued the FCC, which they promptly did, a move that Martin apparently hopes will lead the courts to toss out the cross-ownership ban altogether. For more information, and to download the lyrics to all the media carols, go to chicagomediaaction.org.
KTLA, WTXX, Hartsford Courant, and WGN Radio and TV.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, December 16th. Hello, Bob McChesney here. This is live Media Matters, WIL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, joining us on the air from New Jersey.
Hello.
Hello, Paul.
Anyone there?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, Bob here. Can you hear me? Hello. 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 We'll be right back. Hey, Tom, give me a cue to start. Hi, Bob McChesney here. We're back on the air, I gather, at WILL AM 580.
Anyone there?
Can you hear me? Hello, this is Bob McChesney. You're listening to WILL AM 580 here on WILL. As I said, in Urbana, Illinois, I apologize for the mix-up we've had with our engineering right here. A mix-up, we don't know what accounts for it, but we are back live with you now. Today, we're going to have a terrific show with you. It's one of my privileges on this program to have authors every week come on the air and discuss their books.
Okay, not necessarily. Guys, I'm hearing nothing.
From me? What's going on? Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me?
I can now hear you.
Now, can I go and tell me when I go on the air? Cause I don't know what I'm doing. I can't see anything. Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Can I go on the air? Is this WILL?
This is Paul. This is Paul Krugman here.
Oh, hi, Paul. I'm sorry.
I can hear you, but I don't know if anyone else can hear us.
Well, this is crazy. I'm doing this from my studio in Madison. I'm waiting to get we're live on air. Well, this is a great live radio here in WILL AM 580.
Hello, everybody. Well, we know this is genuine.
This is not a canned show. We have as our guest, who you've already heard, Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and professor of economics at Princeton University, joining us live on the air here. We apologize for the mix-up the last few minutes. We've had some problems with our connection, but they are taken care of now. Paul Krugman, I think, needs no introduction to most of you who have listened to the program. He's been one of our most frequently requested guests over the last couple of years and a popular guest when he's been on the show. He's the author of a brand new book, which I've had the pleasure of reading this week, The Conscience of a Liberal, just published by Norton, and a book I found extraordinarily readable and provocative, and one I urge people to take a close look at if they're interested in politics and media. And I think if you're listening to this show, the answer to both those questions is probably yes. Professor Krugman, if you could start by just telling me, why did you decide to write this book, and why the title?
Okay, I decided to write it partly because there was a lot of ideas I've been working out, and getting them out in 800-word snippets in the New York Times is a little bit short of what I need to make a sustained argument. And I was hoping to inform the debate. We do have an election year coming up. I think we need to talk about where this country can go. The title is a play on Barry Goldwater's 1960 book, The Conscience of a Conservative, which is not a book I admire exactly, but it's a book that marked a real turning point in the direction of American politics, and I'd like to see that happen again, but this time in a direction I prefer.
And that was also the title of a book by Paul Wellstone, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm embarrassed to say that fell through the cracks in my head as I was choosing a title for this book. So I had read Paul Wellstone, but somehow one of those little glitches in the brain cells.
Well, we can regard it as an homage to Paul Wellstone,
yeah.
I think. In the book, what you do is you lay out that argument for why we are at a turning point and what we need to do and revive the liberal and progressive tradition in the United States. And much of the book, over half of it, really goes through the last 100 years of American history, especially the last 40 years, to talk about where we've been. And I found that section of the book especially illuminating, and I urge people to read it. Even people who think they know a lot about American history, I think, will get a lot from this discussion. One of the things you do that's sort of a new framing that I haven't seen before is you regard the entire period from the U.S. Civil War until the 1930s, until the New Deal kicks in. You call that the Long Gilded Age. And explain what you're thinking of with that terminology and what that means for us today.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm an economist, and so I stand back from the political history that we normally think of. We think that, well, when Teddy Roosevelt came in, there were some reforms, there were some changes, which is true, and that's usually where the historians end the Gilded Age, around 1900. But if we're looking at economic inequality, which is, I think, is the core story of what's happened to American politics over the past century, there was very little reduction in inequality. In fact, we're not sure there was any. Basically, America was as unequal a society in 1929 as it had been in 1899. We were still very much a society in which a small number of people controlled a very large part of the country's income, and we were politically a country in which that small economic elite held a dominant political position. So from the point of view of the themes that I'm talking about in this book, the Gilded Age did not end when there was a little bit of a progressive movement in legislation when the Food and Drug Administration was created. It continued right through until the 1930s.
And then what happens in the New Deal, which I think is a real heart of your argument of the book, if I can be so bold, is you talk about something you call the Great Compression.
Yeah, not my term. It's actually Claudia Golden, the economic historian, historian at Harvard. We were still a drastically unequal society up until the mid-1930s. And then over about a 10-year period, we became a middle-class society all at once. The Great Compression, a narrowing of the great income differences in America, and it was a political creation. It's not that, you know, the world, that technology changed or that the global economy changed. It was that we had a government in place that was prepared to do a lot of things that made the middle class stronger and did, in fact, reduce the concentration of income at the top. So it's Social Security and progressive taxation and unemployment insurance and pro-union policies. And so you get this real dramatic change in the nature of our society that is sudden, and it's a political achievement.
And it doesn't go away after the war, which is the interesting thing, because many of these policies were put in place as part of the war effort.
Yeah, if you thought that you know, there were certainly government controls on wages and prices during World War II, and those were administered in a way that led to narrower income differences. But they didn't spring back to the pre-war levels when the war was over. New norms had been created, new expectations about how people should be paid, which is a way of saying that there's a lot less supply and demand and a lot more sociology in income inequality than most people would, certainly than most economists would tell you. There's the idea that, well, there's nothing that can be done about the extreme inequality that we have now, which is, you know, back to Gilded Age levels, is belied by the experience of the Great Compression.
You know, one of the things that was missing in your book, and I was somewhat surprised, was the Keynesian argument, an element of it, and I studied economics, was that less inequality or more equality of incomes is healthy for growing an economy because poorer people have money, they spend it.
Well, I'm not... you know, rich people do spend money too. That's not been a really clear. You know, you can manage to have full employment based on sales at Neiman Marcus rather than sales at Target. So I don't think that's really quite right. The argument for equality is not just that it gets people to spend more. The argument for relative equality is it just that makes a better society.
In the two you've mentioned already, two sort of core policy mechanisms or institutions that were crucial towards creating this Great Compression and creating what you call sort of the middle-class society that dominated the United States from the 40s into the 70s. One is tax policy, and the other is trade unions or labor unions.
Yeah.
And I thought your discussion of labor unions was especially interesting because I think for a lot of our younger listeners, people under, say, the age of 40, they'd really have no idea what this country was like in that era and the role labor unions played.
That's right. We were a country... in not just in living memory, in my memory, we were a country in which 30% of the workforce was unionized. And, of course, it was not paradise. And there were plenty of things to criticize about unions. But it You know, now that we don't have it, you can see how important a strong union movement is to having a reasonable degree of economic democracy. You have to have those unions that are, or at least the potential of unions. So unions have a big effect even on workers who are not unionized at leading to relatively equal pay, disciplining extreme payouts to corporate insiders and so on. And what's amazing is that the decline in the union movement in the United States is very different. It's not the case that unions have become outmoded. There's still strong union movements in the rest of the advanced world. It's a political thing, again, that the union movement has been beaten down into a shadow of its former self.
Our guest today, Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, professor of economics at Princeton University, joining us today live on the phone. We're discussing his brand new book, The Conscience of a Liberal, just published by Norton, climbing the bestseller list as we speak. If you'd like to call in with a telephone call, the number here at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Paul Krugman writes on a variety of political and economic issues in his column, New York Times, so we can field calls, I think, covering a pretty broad range of issues. But in this program right now, in my questioning, I want to talk about the book, which I've had the pleasure of reading over the last week. One of the other points of the book I found really intriguing, Professor Krugman, was your discussion of the movement conservatives, the conservative movement, and putting that into context historically. Now, a lot of people have written about this in the past, so you're not the first, obviously.
Right.
And you're drawing from a lot of other scholars as you put this together. But still, it was rather striking to me when you were talking about, for example, the National Review in the 1950s.
Yeah.
And sort of what, you know, sort of get stripping away the rhetoric to see what actually movement conservatism is all about.
That's right. You go back. I mean, one of the things we do in our history now is we prettify that. You know, we dress it up. So these days, William F. Buckley is a kind of likable old guy in a bow tie, and you think of it as, you know. But if you actually go back and read National Review from the 50s, and you find, first of all, unconditional support for white supremacy in the South. It's in terms that are really quite shocking and startling, basically saying that the whites are the more advanced race and they have the right to do what's necessary to preserve supremacy, regardless of any catalog of the rights of Americans created equal, which is clearly saying never mind the Constitution. And a lot of admiration for Generalissimo Francisco Franco and his dictatorship in Spain. So there's a real authoritarian streak in the movement that goes right back to the beginning. So it's not the case that, you know, some people say, well, we've lost the path. The true conservatives have been, you know, these other guys, the neocons, have come in and driven out the true conservatives. It's not true. This is the movement is the same as it ever was.
And then you sort of, the other end of the bookshelf is with the platform of the 2006 Republican Party of Texas.
Yeah.
You quote at some length because of its striking content.
Yeah, and this is, you know, in Texas, Republicans are free to be Republicans and modern Republicans. They weren't always this way. The Republican Party of Eisenhower was a very different creature. But right now, sure, Social Security is illegitimate. Gay marriage is an abomination in the sight of the Lord. I don't think that's quite the words they use, but it's pretty close. And it's a very, very hard line in terms of the economics, it's basically a renunciation of everything that was achieved from the 30s on. And in terms of social policies, it's certainly very, very hard line.
Our guest, Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, the professor of economics at Princeton University, joining us live on the phone today. We will take phone calls at 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Paul Krugman, the author of the brand-new book, which we're talking about, The Conscience of a Liberal. We're just getting started. There's a lot more to the book. It's very much about the present and the future of this country and the politics that are necessary and the policies that are necessary, with a special emphasis on health care and tax policy. Let's go to the phone lines right now, if we can. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Hi. I wanted to say, first of all, that I'm a great admirer of your writing, and considering that where I derive my political knowledge from, besides just television media, I read online, and I wanted to say thank you to New York Times for removing the firewall so that you're actually much more accessible.
Free at last. Yes, thank you.
It's essentially between New York Times and reading some web blogs like Jerome Armstrong and Marcos Melitzas, like DailyCoast.com. I just wanted to say that this is kind of where I get a lot of my knowledge from. My question is this. From having read you over the last several years and the other liberal and democratic political thinking, there is definitely a tendency to call attention to the problems as opposed to present some of the solutions. And I have something of an idea of what America under Paul Krugman might look like. But I'm curious if you would have, like, maybe a five-point platform that you might want to put forth as to what might be a sound direction to bring America kind of back into a responsible political entity.
So actually, that's the last several chapters of Conscience of a Liberal. But first of all, in terms of concrete policies, you know, universal health care. I would want a single payer system, but the perfect is the enemy of the good, and I'll take a compromise proposal to get the thing established.
And Paul, before you go on, let me just add that you have an entire chapter on health care,
exactly.
And the politics of it, not just the economics, but both.
That's right.
In the book, it's a terrific chapter, and you've been writing about this for the last year or so in your column in the Times.
Yeah, a lot. I mean, healthcare is, I think, the core of where you start, and with a change, and so that's the core of a change in direction in terms of actual policy. Then a set of other less individually critical, but they add up policies. Change the labor policy so it's easier to organize, because I do think that unions are terribly important. Higher minimum wage, we've got some of that now, but there's some further to go. Expansion of programs that provide support for working Americans, like the Earned Income Tax Credit. Beyond that point, it becomes more of a list, so it starts to become a 12-point program rather than a 5-point program. But healthcare, for starters. And I think if you can do that, it not only does a great deal of concrete good for people, but it also shifts the mood of the country. It makes you a country in which people start to understand that actually we can do things to help each other.
You know, Paul Krugman, I had Bob Kuttner on the air a few weeks ago talking about his new book, The Squandering of America.
Yeah.
And he argued in the book and in on the show that one of the problems that Democrats and liberals and progressives have faced increasingly over the last generation is that politics have been removed from sort of economic consequences too much for voters. Voters don't understand if they vote for a candidate, they might actually get positive results from it that could benefit them. And they've gravitated then towards issues that are more spectator than participant.
Yeah, you have part of the problem is you've had a failure to actually introduce government programs that produce big results, when the existing programs that are very important come under challenge, you actually can get voters do rally around defending them.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that in the Social Security debate. I think one of the things, if you want to have a progressive agenda, is you have to come up with something and make it happen and demonstrate results, which is, it's interesting. I have very strong support. I have to argue that healthcare reform will open up the floodgates for a lot more stuff. And the National Review agrees with me. They had a piece a couple of weeks ago, from their point of view, about the grim prospect, and they're very worried that a Democrat might actually manage to implement universal health care, which would shift the country in a liberal direction across the board. So they have the same view.
Yeah, there are two great themes in the book, Paul Krugman, that I'd like you to talk about, and they both are big themes in the book, so they elude short answers, so take whatever time you need. One is the idea that the conservative movement is over, it's dying, it's really, its moment is probably, or could have passed, depending on what the Democrats do.
Yeah.
And the second, and you should probably start here, because I think it leads to the second one, is the idea that when you look for reasons why the conservative movement Republicans have had so much hegemony over the past 25 years in Washington, both in the White House and in Congress, and you go through all the factors that are routinely offered up by political scientists and journalists and pundits, in your view, and you discuss it at some length, the issue really comes down primarily to just white racism.
Or racial backlash. I think
the racial backlash.
So. It's not necessarily as simple as just racism, but anyway, it's very much tied to race. And this view comes out of having spent a lot of time with looking at political science research and talking to the political scientists. And but it can actually be summarized pretty simply. Once you take account of shifts in voting that are very clearly related to racial backlash, there isn't much left over to explain. A rough and ready way of doing this, it's not perfect, but it's not a bad way of doing it, is to just say, well, look, what happens if we ask what has happened besides the switch of Southern whites from being strongly Democratic when the Democrats in the South were the party of Jim Crow to being very strongly Republican now? What's left to explain after you've factored that out? And the answer is basically nothing. So we have all these reasons why voters have abandoned the Democrats over religious issues, abortion, guns, whatever. Then you take a look at the fact that in 1952, 40% of white men outside the South voted Democratic. In 2004, 39% of white men outside the South voted Democratic. Basically nothing happened except that Southern whites switched sides. And that's a much more elaborate version of that is telling you that there really isn't much going on there except the racial backlash politics. There, all the other things that you think might be, that people tell you endlessly or have been crucial, just are explaining something that didn't happen.
And on that point, because you raised this point in the book, and I wasn't really sure what your answer was, what did Southern whites who switched their votes from Democrat to Republican, and as I understood your data, it was the farther up the income scale, the more likely the switch was.
Yeah, so it's an interesting thing. It's not, I probably shouldn't say this, but it's not poor white trash being misled. It's rich white trash being misled. But no, it's upper income, middle and upper income. We're not really talking about just the wealthy, but better off Southern whites are the ones who have swung radically to the right.
Which sort of goes against the sort of the picture of Reagan Democrats, truck drivers, blue-collar workers, who have been sort of the first to leap forth to the Republican ranks.
Yeah, there are no doubt were some of those Reagan Democrats out there. I mean, it is a real group, but it's a lot smaller than people imagine, and it's an interesting. I mean, the question I guess one wants to ask is what exactly does a upper middle class Southern white think he's getting?
Yeah.
Out of this, and the truth is, it's mostly symbolic. There's a little bit of stuff, and some of the appeals about, well, we're taking your money and using it to pay for welfare queens, which is the Reagan line, may be appealing more to upper income voters. But I think a lot of it is really symbolic. It is about, when Reagan went and said in 1980 that the Voting Rights Act of 1965 had been humiliating to the South, he wasn't actually proposing to repeal the Voting Rights Act, but he was giving some salve to hurt pride. And I think that's unfortunately what it's about. Or fortunately, because there hasn't really, no one, not even these moving conservatives I dislike so much, they haven't proposed bringing back Jim Crow.
Our guest, Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist, professor of economics at Princeton, joining us today live on the phone. We're discussing his brand new book, The Conscience of a Liberal. Our phone lines are open at 333-9455, toll free 1-800-222-9455. 1 week from today, our guest will be Naomi Wolf here on Media Matters. 2 weeks from today, December 30th, John Nichols will be joining us live. We'll be talking about the upcoming presidential caucuses and primaries and the media coverage of presidential politics this year. And then going to the success of the conservative movement over the last three decades, say, Professor Krugman, then going to its crisis today. And you're quite optimistic in some sense that its moment is passing.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things. One is the race really has been the core of what's allowed the political success, but the country has changed. It's become more diverse. It's become much more tolerant. Not by any means that the issue is over, and some of the emotional reactions to the immigration issue show that there are still these things going on. But for me the perfect illustration of the change was the 2006 senatorial election in Virginia, when the Macaca incident, when Senator George Allen, who was regarded as a shoo-in for re-election, made a racial insult against a young American man of South Asian descent who was working for the other campaign, and that turned out to be that lost him the election. That's unacceptable in today's America, and that's telling you how much the country has changed. On the economic issues, the public has become aware of rising inequality. Not that they, look at tables from the Congressional Budget Office, but that people have a sense that they're being left behind, and they're upset, and there's a really strong tide of demands for something being done about the inequalities of our society, all of which is creating a real opportunity for progressives who offer a platform of change to really, really make those changes.
You go in the book through a lot of the data on the growth of inequality, the rising inequality of the past three decades, say, and it's really striking when you put it all together. It is astonishing. When you deal with people who are unsympathetic to your political views and they see this data about the how really the great increases in productivity and output have the benefits of those have skewed so heavily towards the very top of the income spectrum, how do they respond to that?
Their usual argument, aside from just denial, and there is a bit of that, a fair bit of that. There's a lot of it's kind of like global warming. There are some people who refuse to believe it's true because it would be so inconvenient for them if it were true. But those who do accept the data basically say, well, but there are good reasons for this. It's an increasing payoff to skill and education, and there's nothing you can do about it that wouldn't do much more harm than good. Really, it's about so the conservative economists who are reputable conservative economists will concede that there's been a big increase in inequality, but they'll say, well, there's nothing. Try to tax it away, or try to do anything to return towards historical levels of equality, it'll destroy the economic growth. It'll be very damaging to the country, and so that's where the argument really is. It's the honest argument is not that it hasn't happened, but that nothing can be done about it.
And your argument, and I think you demonstrate in the book, is that doesn't hold up to a lot of scrutiny.
Yeah, that you can look certainly the argument that raising taxes on the wealthy a little bit is going to be really bad runs up against the immediate point that, well, Clinton did that, not a tremendous amount, but he did it, and was followed by a huge economic boom. And beyond that, you look at more broadly at the evidence. We have people use European, what they believe to be true about European economies as an argument. Well, look at the French. They do a lot of equalizing, and their economy is a disaster. And the truth is, it's not true. The truth is that they have problems, as do we all. But even drastic equalizing measures, because France is completely at the opposite end of the spectrum from the United States, still leave an economy that does very well on a number of measures.
Do any of the current presidential candidates, and I assume this would be restricted largely to the Democratic side, seem to get it? When you wrote this book, were you thinking there are some of them who seem to grasp these issues better than others?
Well, in terms of the actual policy proposals on the table, all of the leading Democrats are offering quite progressive policies, much more so than I think anyone would have imagined possible 2 years ago, on health care, which is my what I focus on most. The Obama plan is weaker than the Clinton and Edwards plans, but it's still significantly more progressive. In terms of the way that they talk, John Edwards sounds most like this book, I guess you have mm-hmm. to say. It's and Barack Obama least like it. I mean, I talk about the sort of underlying reasons why we have such a bitter partisan climate in our politics, and basically say they have to be resolved the way they were resolved by FDR. First, the progressives win big, and then eventually the other side gives in. And Obama wants to reach out and achieve bipartisan solutions. If he gets there, I wish him luck, but I don't think it's going to happen.
Our guest, Paul Krugman. Let's go to the phone lines right now. We have a couple callers been waiting very patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Paul Krugman. Line one, Urbana, you there? Looks like we've lost line one. I apologize for taking so long. Let's go to line two now. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Since you're suggesting that racism is so important and that it's symbolic, it's sort of this response to indignation, it seems to me that lower class Southerners, white trash, whatever you want to call it, whether they may not be participating, but they can also, you know, benefit in their own minds from this symbolic concept. I think probably that'd be better handled in your book. But I wanted to ask you, since so often Greenspan, who was on again today, was asked about your column, is there any chance that you'll be on with him directly, that we can actually see you go head-to-head? I know Naomi Klein and Greenspan were on Democracy Now!, and you've been on Democracy Now!, and I just love to see it happen. I don't think he'll do it, but...
Yeah, it would be very interesting to see it happen. I have... I'm game, but I haven't had any offer to do that. It's... yeah, I mean, I obviously, you know, I'm not, I don't view Greenspan as the devil, but I do think he's done a lot of, he has a lot to answer for, and I'd like to hear, I'd like to be able to pose that question to him directly, sure.
Paul Krugman, one of the things that this caller refers to, and what you've written about in your column, and this is sort of an emphasis in Kuttner's book, was that, you know, the path we're on right now with the policies that movement conservatives have put this country on for economic and social policies are really, you know, leading us to a point of severe crisis. You've written about this, especially with the financialization and the growth of debt. And that doesn't show up as much in your book.
No, well, partly it wasn't. I have to admit, I'm surprised by just how bad the fallout from the housing crisis had been. I actually did see it coming, but I didn't realize that the financial ramifications were going to spread as deeply. I didn't realize how deep into basically delusional investment we were. So this is coming as a surprise. So that this is, I didn't think we were going to have so timely an issue on at the time the book was done. We didn't, you know, the true depth of the subprime crisis wasn't obvious to the markets anyway until August of this year, and given publication lead times, it couldn't be in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But no, this is it is, but it strengthens the parallels with the New Deal even more. I mean, one of my favorite quotes from Franklin Roosevelt was that he said that we have always known that the heedless pursuit of self-interest was bad morals. We now know that it is bad economics as well, and that turned out to be exactly true in this financial crisis that's now developing. We had this ideological belief that complex financial schemes that nobody understood were necessarily good for the country because, after all, the market is always right, and it turns out not so.
Now, you use the analogy to the New Deal, which, of course, came in to power, and as you make clear in the book, and in a view that's not unoriginal or uncommon, the New Deal was a response to the Great Depression,
right.
The economic crisis of the times. I don't want you to necessarily look in a crystal ball, but you are an economist. You write about this. What sort of path do you, and what's the range of possibilities for our economy over the next year or two, as you see it?
Okay. I think it ranges from... bad to horrible. It's a range of stuff. I mean, at best, we're going to have a weak year that isn't officially a recession, but will feel like one to a lot of people. There's no way you're going to have a good year of economic growth looking forward. So probably, I think it's very hard to see anything which won't lead to at least some rise in the unemployment rate and a lot of home foreclosures and just a generally difficult situation. Probably at this point, better than even odds that it becomes something that actually is formally a recession, which would be significantly worse. And there's some risk out there. I don't know quite how to put a number on it, but that this financial thing will be really bad, that it will be that we'll actually have a more severe slump than we've had at least since the early 1980s. There's a lot of sensible people are seriously worried about that, because every time we think we've plumbed the depths of this housing-related, subprime-related crisis, it turns out there is another few hundred billion dollars of losses that people hadn't factored in.
And you had a very nice column on it this week in the Times, where you sort of explained it again in very clear language that I applaud you for being able to do, where you talk about the Pottersville Bank. And the problem is that if the underlying economy is weak, then all these shenanigans really can't be stopped, or the damage can't be stopped that easily.
Yeah, that's right. We had the model that people have in their minds for how this gets resolved is what happened when there was a pretty scary financial crisis for a few weeks in 1998. And basically Greenspan lent a bunch of money out, and Greenspan and Rubin went around looking very competent, and the whole thing just sort of evaporated. And that's not going to happen this time, because there's a lot of very real, irreversible losses. You can't. It's not just a crisis of confidence. As I think I said in the column, it's not an irrational panic on the part of the markets. It's a wholly rational panic on the part of the markets. And so this is going to be difficult. That's why we can be sure that it's not going to be a good year for the economy, and there's significant reason to think that it could be a really bad year.
Is there an actual economic connection between the extraordinary cost of the Iraq invasion and occupation and the state of the economy, or are they really two separate issues?
They're really two separate issues. I mean, the Iraq, you know, on any absolute scale, Iraq is an incredible outrageous expense, and compared with a lot of things we ought to be doing. We spend the proposed expansion of children's health insurance, which Bush vetoed, would have cost to cover 4 million children for the next 5 years, would have cost what we will spend in the next, I think, 41 days in Iraq. So it's a huge amount of money, but this is a big economy we've got here, and even very large sums don't look that large compared with the economy. So we're still spending in Iraq, relative to the size of the economy, well under half what we were spending on Vietnam. So yes, it's probably going to be $2 trillion by the time all is said and done. And a trillion here, a trillion there, and soon you're talking about real money. But it's actually still not central to the economic outlook.
Our guest, Paul Krugman from the New York Times, economics professor at Princeton. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 1, Pasodom, Illinois, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Love your show. I've got 4 points that if you have time to address them. Seems like, one, that the Republican sound bites always work better. And I'm basing this on conversations with people at work. And the second one is, I'm wondering if there's not too much of a preoccupation with the profit in the stock market these days, and people and companies don't care about what happens to social justice. And then another issue is from people that I've known coming up through the ranks, that it's like a frog in the water deal. Instead of plunge them in boiling water, you heat the water gradually, and they haven't realized what's happening to them because of the gradual slide. And then the fourth point is that all the conservatives I know, no matter how much they complain about progressive ideas, are the first to line up at the trough. And thank you, and I'll hang up and listen.
Okay,
thank you very much.
I don't know if I can deal with all of those. Soundbite issue. Part of the problem has been that because the Democrats have been so much more so spooked at the idea that America isn't ready for things that sound liberal, they tend to have these complicated, nuanced stuff. I would have said that health care for all is a pretty good soundbite, and so we'll see. But it's certainly been true in the past. But it's mostly because government bad, taxes bad, is easier than complicated descriptions of things you're going to do. But maybe a really forthright progressive program will make the difference. What can I say about the the frog in the boiling pot is a I think is a very good analogy, because year by year, what happens is not that extreme, and yet cumulatively, what we've had over the past quarter century or so is a situation in which step by step, working Americans have been deprived of the benefits of a more productive economy, and it just kind of adds up, and it comes to seem normal. So there was a time when the idea that you could be working for a large corporation and not have health benefits would have been considered very odd. Now we have, you know, America's largest employer, Walmart, has very poor health benefits, and it's come to be accepted as something that's normal.
And then the last point was the trough.
Oh, the trough. Well, everybody. Sure. I mean, it's really remarkable that spending spending money to provide kids with health care, that's socialism. But you know, one way or another, spending a lot to rescue corporations or is that's a sound policy. And sure, I mean, to some extent, that's just human nature. Everybody does it. I know the story of the famous libertarian philosopher who fought extremely hard to keep his rent-controlled apartment. So you know, we hear that all the time. But it is striking here, especially because the sums are so large. I mean, what's been spent on essentially wasteful privatization is compared with what it would cost to provide a lot of very needy people in America with some basic necessities, just tells you just how extreme the hypocrisy really is.
Yeah, I mean, I just to pursue this point a little further, because you do discuss this in The Conscience of a Liberal at times. And one of the striking things, so I read the book and it conformed to my own historical work, you know, was the New Deal, the big government New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt, as you point out, had, you know, the squeakiest, cleanest ethics record in memory of any, despite being increasing the size of government and government programs dramatically. So it'd be very easy for stuff to sort of get away from the eyesight of people in charge. And then now we have the conservative movement, which was predicated on the idea of small, accountable government that would not get in the way of people's lives and not be out of control. And we've seen corruption and cronyism, as you point out in the book. I mean, it's really, I don't know if they're all-time levels, but they're extraordinary levels.
Yeah, I think it's probably unprecedented, because the last time we had people this corrupt running the government was a lot smaller than it is today. So, and look, yeah, it's partly philosophy. I mean, if you are a political movement committed to the idea that government can do things to improve people's lives, then you actually have a very strong incentive to make sure that the government is run in ways that don't discredit that effort. And that's what happened with the New Deal. So the Works Progress Administration, which was a sort of the very image of what you would now think would be a boondoggle, government spending a lot of money in a discretionary way on particular projects, was hedged about with very, very careful controls to prevent corruption, and it never did. There were no serious problems of misuse of public funds. Whereas if your administration that is committed to the idea that government is always the problem, never the solution, then actually, even if you fail miserably, even if you have a completely corrupt, disastrous government agency, to some extent you can say, well, look, that proves my point. And you actually saw that after Hurricane Katrina. A large number of people on the right, instead of saying this proves that the Bush administration really messed up, they said it just proves the government can't work, because it was, you know, as if having the former head of the Arabian Horse Association run the government's premier emergency management agency is, you know, that, well, that's what always happens.
How confident, Paul Krugman, are you that the Democrats, assuming they get the White House and maintain control of Congress, or even if they don't, but just as a party, are going to get it? You write in the book, and it's been written about, for example, with Senator Schumer of New York, and how he led the fight basically to keep the taxes on the richest people in this country, the hedge fund managers, oftentimes with incomes in the hundreds of millions of dollars, at a lower rate than the standard rate.
No, I'm really worried at a couple of levels. I mean, I think I'm hopeful, but also worried. So one issue is the role of corporate contributions. We do have a system that where money is very important in politics, and you know, companies are giving a lot to Democrats right now, and they think they're buying something. So this is going to be one concern. I'm also concerned that we might not have enough, and are these people going to be tough enough? Is, in the end, a President Clinton or a President Obama or maybe even a President Edwards going to, in the end, really be prepared to stand up to the hail of opposition that they'll face in trying to really make changes?
Our guest, Paul Krugman, we have time for one final caller. Let's go to line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Oh, that's fucking me. I am very concerned that my favorite guy, who is Kucinich, is hardly getting any airtime, even from NPR, which is supposed to be better about these things. What do you have to say about that? And, you know, he's for universal health care, all the good things.
Yeah, there's always, I mean, I haven't written about him, and I'm certainly for his plans. I guess there's always some question that if you're trying to get things done of making trade-offs between between the ideal and what you think is doable. And I think this applies here. Kucinich is not going to get the Democratic nomination. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he shouldn't be given a lot of attention if you think his ideas are good, but it does raise some questions about priorities. And that's all I can say. I mean, instead of people, let's talk about policies on health care. I like Medicare for all. If I thought we could get that, I'd be saying that's the policy to go with. And there are people I respect who are saying, you know, why not just push for the right solution? But I don't think we can get that politically for some very good reasons. I don't think we can get that anytime soon, whereas I think a hybrid proposal like the ones that Edwards, Clinton, Obama are putting out might actually be accomplished. So if you give me the choice between an imperfect form of universal coverage, which might actually be in effect by like 2011, and single payer, which probably can't happen until 2018 or something, then I'm going to choose the imperfect form, but I might be wrong in that judgment.
We've only got a couple minutes left. If that, Paul Krugman, I want to thank you for joining us. I do want to ask you, how has the response to the book been so far?
Oh, it's been terrific. I mean, the book tour, a lot of people are looking for hope. A lot of people are looking for an explanation of you know, how did we get here? How did this happen? These last 7 years have been politically a nightmare for many people, and they want to know, you know, how do we get here and how do we get out? So there's been bookstore events have been a little bit like revival meetings, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
The reception's been great, and I hope provide people with a framework for thinking about where we go from here. I mean, that's the goal. I'm not going to change people's basic philosophy, but I might be able to help them think more clearly about how we got here and what we can realistically do now to change the country's direction.
Well, I can safely say, having read the book, that it does exactly that. And even if someone disagrees with your politics, it's an argument they would value engaging with and taking up seriously. And certainly anyone who's liberal or progressive needs to read this book and engage with it. I hear the band tuning up in the background, Professor Krugman. That means they want to kick me out of the studio.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us, taking time out of your Sunday. It's been a real honor to have you on the air with us.
Thanks a lot. It's been great being on.
All right. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. I'll be back next week with Naomi Wolf. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, Brett Polson, engineer, and see you then. Have a good week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, increasingly cloudy with a high in the mid-20s, blustery with northwest winds 20 to 25 miles per hour, which can cause blowing and drifting snow. Tonight, partly cloudy and colder with a low around 10 degrees and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly sunny with a high in the upper 20s and southwest winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana, the listener-supported broadcast service of the University of Illinois. It's 2 p.m. The Tavis Smiley Show is next.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. It's the case of the missing CIA interrogation tapes, and concern is growing as legislators probe why they were destroyed amid growing concerns over terrorism, torture, and national security.
We have to use some techniques that are clearly not torture, but necessary to bring high-value witnesses into an attitude of cooperation.
It's for the sake of getting better intelligence, and ultimately for the protection of Americans, that we want this oversight.
Also, commentator Cornel West remembers literary giant James Baldwin 20 years after his death. We got a preview of the 2008 Olympics from former Olympian and current IOC member Anita DeFrance. Plus, Grammy-winning gospel singer Fred Hammond shares what made the cut on his new CD, The Essential Fred Hammond. This hour of the Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, after the news.